Welcome to this Brain Radar Radio podcast. I'm Neil Slade, and today I'm speaking with brain education researcher Mary Lou, is the nickname I call her, Marie Gutierrez Oosthuizen, is that correct?
Marie-Louise Oosthuizen
Gutierrez. Oh, I got it a little bit backwards there.
A whole mouthful.
Say that again. I want to hear it one more time.
Marie-Louise Oosthuizen Gutierrez.
Mary Louise, that's right. Okay.
That one, yeah. That
My
one.
Problem is, see, I just call you by your nickname in email and whenever we speak on the phone. So that's a real...
Correct.
That's a bit of a tongue twister there for us.
It is.
Middle America Americans, you know. So, and I'm calling you to Mexico City where you live, correct?
That's correct, yes. I live in Mexico City.
How long have you, you know, we talked about your background last year a bit, but give me a little refresher course. Where you grew up and how you came to settle in Mexico City, because I think it's an interesting story.
Well, I'm South African, and I grew up in a little town called Grahamstown in the Eastern Cape Province in South Africa. I studied, of all things, physical education, and but of course there is a very big link between the brain and the body, obviously, and I've always been very interested in what happens in the brain. Why would I sometimes have wonderful insights into things and then on the next level do really very badly in certain subjects, for instance? So there was obviously, so I was obviously not completely stupid as I thought I was. There was something there, but why could I not tap into it always, you know? So that was always very interesting for me. And of course, once I got married, I moved to United States, I think it was in 1983. I was working at the South African Embassy for the South African Department of Foreign Affairs.
Oh, yes.
I was transferred to the embassy there where I met my husband, who was an economist at the World Bank.
You did cryptography, and is that correct?
That's correct. I did cryptography at the embassy. I was a cryptographer.
Decoding all of those spy messages, is that?
That's it, yes. Coding and decoding all the classified information. Yes, that's right.
Okay, and so go on.
So I can tell you all about it, but then I'll have to kill you afterwards.
Okay, all right. But that's where you met your husband, who was from Mexico, is that correct?
Yes, that's right. He's Mexican. And he was worked as an economist at the Inter-American Development Bank and then at the World Bank. And we got married in 1989. After I stopped working at the embassy, then I went to work at Intelsat, which is the International Telecommunication and Satellites Organization, as a data technician, and which was very interesting also. And there I worked on maintaining big databases that had all the information regarding the Earth stations that had access to the Intelsat system throughout the world. So, so we got married around 1989, and I really became interested in the brain after 1990, after my first daughter was born, 1991, and seeing how her brain had to be ready to do something before the body would follow. So if she wanted to start crawling, her brain had to be ready first.
Now, how was that indicated?
Body would follow.
How was that indicated to you? How did you know that?
I could see it through her frustration. I could see that she wanted to do something, and she didn't know how to do it, and it would become very frustrating to her.
So she had
by
kind of
closely watching her, and seeing that she is ready to do something, but she doesn't know, quite know how to do it, which means that the brain is there, the brain is ready to do it, and now the body must follow.
Well, at the very least, she had the concept of what she wanted to do, or the image of what she wanted to do in her brain, but
yes,
the body had not let figured out how to connect the dots, as it were.
Exactly. So, exactly.
Or in literally, it didn't. She didn't have the neural pathways within her brain and interconnected with her body to perform those, you know,
exactly,
what she saw in her imagination.
At 4 months of age, wanting to go from one point to another and not knowing how to, and then literally starting to roll because she wasn't strong enough to push up onto her.
Well, I want to pursue that more in a second, but just tell me just briefly about your background in brain education. And how you trained or got ready for that?
Well, as I said, that sparked my interest and sparked me to start reading up about it. And then in the 90s, with computers and emails and being able to get information so much easier on the computer, and then of course with the advent of Google, so much information out there. So I found a program as well, how can I train for, how can I learn more about the brain? And I did a bit of research and found a program at the University of Washington in Seattle, Washington, and it was a certification program where they actually teach you how to look at research that has already been performed, because not all have grants or access to do specific research, but to look at research that has already been done, and then to see how can you take that and apply it to a specifically education. Because I was also a teacher, I also have a teaching diploma, of course, and so the teaching aspect of it was always interesting to me. And I have studied physical education also. And here in Mexico, I was teaching English, and thinking of ways, well, how can I teach it in order for my students to learn faster?
Yes.
Or to become proficient a bit faster.
Yes. And I, the first book that I wrote was along those same lines as well, because I was a teacher. And I was constantly being asked by parents and, you know, how can we help our son or daughter learn better, learn music better, whatever. And we had that same need as well. You know, I went about it one way, and you certainly went about it in a very studious manner as well. Now, I want to get back, because you were talking about your daughter, and what kind of things did you experience that you found you were able to aid her in different kinds of things? Do you have some illustrations of that?
Well, as I was saying, I could see that she wanted to, for instance, she saw something across the room and she wanted to get there, but she didn't know how to. And then how she literally figured out to start rolling, because she was 4 months old, and she obviously was, her hips and shoulders were not strong enough yet to keep her weight up in order to try and crawl over there, and which was also a process she had to learn. So she figured out how to roll in order to get there.
Really? I've never heard of babies rolling to move around. I haven't had any of my own kids, so I wouldn't have that firsthand experience. What kinds of things did you find yourself doing to aid in her, you know, well, I mean, this has got, that would be a whole program in and of itself, I'm sure. But what occurred to you in terms of helping her brain to develop these motor skills and any other kinds of skills as she was growing? How old is she now?
Oh, she's 23.
Oh, well, okay.
Yes, she's 23 and very coordinated and have very good fine motor abilities, but as I say, I basically learned so much from her, and then, of course, later with my second daughter, who had, I wouldn't say not a problem, but she was one. You often have children who sit, and they sit very well, and then they go from sitting to standing to walking without crawling in between.
Oh.
So, of course, I have heard that they said, no, it is very important for children to crawl. They have to go through the crawling phase. For the hand-eye coordination, and also in order to exercise the muscles in the hips and in the shoulders, for them to strengthen them before they actually stand up and start walking.
But you're saying your second daughter just skipped that.
So she was just sitting. She refused to crawl. So we would make Cassandra and I, Cassandra is the elder one, would then make a game out of it by
Oh.
crawling around the room and getting her to then try and crawl with us. And then in the end, yes, she did.
Oh, I see.
And she became a very good crawler, a very fast crawler also.
Were there any brain specific things that came to mind, or did you take a much more holistic kind of approach to her,
I would
growing up
say
and
at that point in time, I took a more of a holistic approach. Didn't know all that much about it. There's a lot of advice that gets given, and as I say, information that was not always as easily accessible as it is now.
right. And
It was only just the beginnings of the internet,
right.
back in '92.
So this was before a lot of your brain research had ha happened.
Exactly.
Oh,
Yes,
okay.
that was
Well,
quickly before that.
tonight you said you want to speak about mathematics of the brain, and I'm anxious to get into that. Let me preface it with saying that I am among the world's worst mathematicians myself. I can do simple addition, and I can do long division up to three decimal points. No, not decimal points, just three columns, like 100. And that's about it. I have no mathematical skills whatsoever. In fact, I cannot even believe that I ever even passed an algebra class in my life, but I must have back in my youth. So let's get into the math. What inspired you to start investigating math and the brain? Am I putting that right?
Math. I have the exact same problem as you have. I come from a family who were all very good in math, most of them. My mother actually studied, she had two majors, and this was back in the 1940s when she went to university, early 50s. She actually studied mathematics and music. And she had two majors, which were both of those. She was very into math. My father was good in math. My brothers were good in math. My sister was good in math. I was the baby in the family, number four. I was good in sports. So my math abilities were similar to yours, actually.
Well, my father has always used to tell me, he says, you're a musician, you should be good at math because music is like math. And but it just wasn't the case. I math was like Martian to me.
Well, they do say that my mother always used to say, well, math and music, it's basically the same thing. But I think it's especially if you go more into the theoretical side of music. So music theory and really studying music from the musical theory point of view.
Well, you know, but the thing is, I mean,
the
when you,
mathematics of it.
well,
If you study more in terms of the rhythm, the pitch, the sounds, and less from a theoretical point of view, I don't think you get the exact same mathematical effect, if you would.
Yeah, I might argue with you on that one because I did study a lot of composition and I studied counterpoint, but the biggest I would you would count up to 16. You know, you'd have four bars of 4/4. And that is about as much as the math went and for me. So I think people who say math is like music, they don't really play music.
Well, according to the research that's out there, it says that children who receive traditional music instruction don't really show a math improvement. However, if the musical instruction that they do receive gives a lot of attention to sequential skill developments and to rhythm and pitch development, after about 6 months, they do see a major improvement in their math skills.
Oh, that's interesting. That's
So it has to do with a certain aspect of music. So the sequential skill development, that also helps with reading, for instance. And rhythm and pitch development, that would help with firing of the neurons in a rhythmical manner.
Well, there now
And
I wonder about that because typically, and when this is when you speak of non-musicians, the music is typically more of a right-brained type of activity. But I would expect that mathematics is primarily a left-brained activity. So is the better development due to the opposite side of the brain being stimulated, or is there something else happening there?
Okay, so if you look at the brain and the areas that are actually used for mathematics, they have found that there are very specific areas that have to do with numerical calculations. For instance, one of them is the inferior parietal lobe, which has been shown, which you have one in the left hemisphere as well as one in the right hemisphere.
Well, for those who don't know, for those who don't know, explain where the parietal lobe is located on the
The
brain.
parietal lobe, you have, if you look at the brain, you have the frontal lobe, which is the frontal area, which up until more or less the middle, then that would be the motor cortex. So I'm going from the front over towards the back. So about half of the brain, that would be the frontal lobe. Then right, more or less in the middle, there's a small a swatch that goes down maybe 2 inches wide, which would be the motor cortex. Then you will
And the
find
motor, let me
further
explain.
back,
Let me explain to
from the middle
people.
of the head towards the top end of the head, that would be the parietal cortex. And then from more or less the top back of the head towards the bottom bump that you feel, that would be the occipital lobe. So we're talking about the parietal lobe, which is behind the frontal lobe and behind the motor cortex. So the inferior parietal cortex is now located, if you come down towards your ear, it's like more or less just above the ear.
Above the back part
Inferior,
of the ear.
just above and behind the ear, I would say. Just at the top end of the ear and a little behind.
Okay, so were you saying the left hemisphere parietal lobe or the right hemisphere or both is involved in this mathematical processing?
So in both hemispheres,
Okay, so
both hemispheres.
unlike the verbal part of the brain, which tends to be on the left side, you're saying math really is taking place in both the right and left hemispheres.
Correct. There you've got it now. And that's where most people think that it's merely a left hemisphere function. It is not. The better you are at math, the better both hemispheres are connected and better you are using both of them at the same time.
That's very
The
interesting.
corpus callosum has to be very well connected between those two areas in order to assure that there's a good connection between the two so they can communicate. So the best mathematicians are able to use both left and right hemispheres. It's not just a one hemisphere function, but each hemisphere has a different function. For instance, the parietal in the inferior parietal lobe of the left hemisphere, that's where we do exact calculations, all mental calculations, where we see numbers as language. So therefore, say the number 6 would be SIX instead of the symbol. In the right hemisphere, you would see the symbol.
Oh, very interesting. Yes.
You would see multiplication, division, addition, all the when you learn your mathematical tables, it would be stored also in the left hemisphere.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So any kind of procedures, so mathematical procedures that you have to memorize, all of that is stored in the left hemisphere.
Would I be
right hemisphere? You do approximations, you see the symbols, you do basic calculations, and you do spatial rotations.
I would expect that geometry would be happening on that right side.
Correct, yes. That's right.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So in the left hemisphere, we see numbers as symbols, but we also see them as written down, like 2 TWO, you know, or you would see the symbol two.
I see. Well, I'm wondering now, growing up as a musician, I played a lot by ear and I read music. I didn't really deal with music theory at all. And then again, as I've reported, I was not good at math. So I'm wondering if that's because my musical calculations primarily involve spatial types of relationships and not these other types of brain processes that would be more at home in that left side of the brain. I'm just guessing. I don't know.
It could absolutely very well be so, for sure.
Uh-huh.
Well, they say that normally children who receive instrumental instruction, so which is what you did, they would score better in spatial temporal cognition and hand-eye coordination, as well as arithmetic.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so which are the basic calculations?
I get it.
More of a right, which is more of a right hemisphere function.
Uh-huh. Now,
but it also says that, and I think this is because of the connection between the two hemispheres, these children who do receive instrumental instruction are actually able to perform complex arithmetic operations.
Well, we all know that Einstein.
Time,
excuse me?
If you had given it the time, or maybe had a better teacher, someone who was able to inspire you better, you would have probably developed that ability better.
Yeah, it probably just comes down to I wasn't that interested in it. So
exactly.
And
exactly.
From our last conversation, I remember you saying that if you want to learn something well, what is imperative is that you are interested in what you are learning. So that would carry through to my experience.
Oh, yes, absolutely. No, definitely.
Well, tell me some more about math and the brain. That covers a little bit of the neurology.
Right.
What else have you discovered?
Okay, well, we said that we all have a number sense. And that is something that we are actually born with. We have had this number sense for at least 30 million years.
And what does that mean?
The number sense, that means that we are able to approximate things. We are able to compare and approximate things. We have a perceptual concept of the numbers 1, 2, and 3, and maybe also 4. The brain can compute them without the ability of actually counting as such. For instance, babies, they tested newborn babies and they were 4 days old, and they found that these babies actually had the abstract ability of numerosity, and they could take something that they heard auditively, a sound that they heard auditively, and they could transfer it into a visual format, because what they do was they would make sounds like toot toot, and then they would show two pictures to the baby on a screen, and one that had two dots on it and another picture that had three dots on it, and the baby would stare longer at the two dots because it heard two sounds. And babies could do that for numbers up to 4 sounds. So they would hear the sound toot, 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 and then they would look at the picture that has 4 dots longer than any of the other pictures.
Oh, very interesting. Now, you said that this has been something that, I guess, the scientists who researched this felt that this had been something that had been around for a very long period of time in human history.
Exactly.
How was that determined?
Well, and animals, all mammals have it. Animals also have it.
Oh, really?
If you think about it, like for two baboons encounter a group of, say, 6 baboons, they know, that maybe from another tribe or another group, they know that either they have to run or they have to be friendly, because if they fight these guys, they are more than we are, because the concept of more and less, they can also understand.
I see.
So it has to do with our survival, which is why we need this number sense.
But do you, and you may not know this, but how did they determine that this was something that existed? How were they able to put a timeline on that, as it were? That they know that this, that humans had this ability? Is that just by looking at lower creatures on the evolutionary tree or whatever that have this ability?
I would assume that was more or less how they did it.
Okay.
Because, and I think they were able to figure out more or less how long have we had certain structures within our brain.
Oh, I see. Okay.
As we evolved.
Yes.
And one of the structures that they pinpointed that where we have this number sense, which is in the inferior parietal lobe, and also the intraparietal sulcus, which is the fold that separates the superior and the inferior parietal cortex, so which means the upper and the lower part of the parietal cortex, right within that fold, in that sulcus, is where we have our number sense.
And the sulcus,
and we have had that fold in our brains for at least 30 million years.
Yes, okay, I understand how that was gotten to. For those who don't know what a sulcus is, that's the, we have folds in the outside of our brain. Whenever you look at, a picture of the brain, you see these valleys and peaks, and they're folds. And the sulcus is the indented portion.
Exactly.
What is the word for I've forgotten the word for the bump. Do you know what that is? They're similar words. I'll have to look that up in my neurology textbook. since I don't do brain surgery, I don't keep that on the tip of my tongue.
Well, me neither.
Gyrus. It's called a gyrus. That's the word.
Of course, the gyrus and the sulcus.
There we go. Hey, you know what's always intrigued me is how the memory works. How on earth, where did that come from? Because I knew I had known that at one time. Maybe this was a month ago, was the last time, or 2 months ago. I hadn't used it, so it was in my subconscious. And there was this little program in my brain that said, search and retrieve the term. And so while we're talking, my subconscious and unconscious is running this little program in the background, and it's searching, and all of a sudden it just bubbles up to the top of my consciousness. And that process of retrieving a memory like that, and doing it not as a matter of will, but it's almost it happens beyond your will. I always found that to be just the most fascinating process. And
It is, isn't it? It really is. And what they're also we're talking about memory, what they've also found is that memory is not just in one specific place, like one file cabinet, and that's where you have everything. No, memory is stored all over the brain. Wherever you use the sections where you use that type of information, that's where that neural network, where all those connections have been made, and that's where that information is then stored. That's why oftentimes they say it's easier if you have to write a test, that you write it in the class, in the same classroom where you actually learned the material, where you heard about the material.
Oh, really? I have not heard that before. I wonder, this might be an interesting experiment. You're studying for a test. Okay? Now, obviously, you can't take the test with your notes in front of you. However, while you're studying, what if you were to have a fragrance or a bit of food? And while you learn a bit of information, you take a whiff of, rose petals or something. Now, when you go to take your test over that same material, I wonder, now you probably would be allowed to have a little bottle of fragrance with you. If you couldn't remember something that you had studied, you take a whiff of that fragrance if that would aid in the retrieval of that memory. Do you follow what I'm saying?
Yes, absolutely.
As a memory aid. Have you ever heard of such a thing?
It has been shown that that definitely would help. Also, body position. If you are trying to remember something that you said, try to imitate, try to remember what was the body position that you had when you said that. And if you have that same body position, you remember what you said so much easier.
So
Also.
we're talking about ways of legally cheating.
Yes, definitely legally cheating,
You
yes.
can't have your notes, but you can have your bottle of rose petal perfume with you. Then you can remember what you were studying about better. That's very interesting. I would suppose maybe, using the same pencil or pen, wearing the same clothes, all of these little things that would help you to be in that place where you had all that information at your fingertips.
Exactly, yes. Yeah, those are all study aids.
Interesting. Well, let's get back to math a little
Study
bit.
aids.
Tell me more what some math
Okay,
information in the brain.
well, some other things that I found that were very interesting, which has to do, because a lot of people always talk about, math. Men are better at math and women are better at verbal information
Is that a fallacy?
and so on, right? So, well, if we look at the brain, and if we look at what actually helps to develop numerical areas in the brain, one hormone stands out quite a bit more than any other, and that is testosterone. So, for instance, if you want to look at similarities between males and females, by about 4 months gestation in utero, we have, for instance, our how do you call, fingerprints have already been developed. So if anybody looks at their finger, their hands right now, both left and right hands, if, for instance, you have more lines on your right hand, so on the finger, on your, on the fingertips, so more lines on the right hand, that means you will have what they call more masculine abilities. Now, this has nothing to do with being gay or not. That's not what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
When I say masculine abilities, that just refers to better spatial abilities, better math abilities, also more aggression.
Okay.
And female abilities means better at verbal abilities, better verbal abilities, better at taking care of things, more detail-oriented. So if your right hand has more lines on your fingertips, that means that you have more masculine abilities, which means that there was more testosterone in utero when you were developed within the first 4 months of gestation.
Uh-huh.
If you have more lines on the left-hand side, that means you have more feminine abilities, which means better verbal abilities, looking after things, more detail-oriented.
Now, I always thought that you had the same amount of fingerprint lines on the left and right hand. So you're saying that's not...
Apparently not.
Okay. Well, on my hand, they seem to be about the same. So maybe I had a balanced level of testosterone in my system.
Yeah, well, I know mine seem a bit thicker on the right hand and a bit finer on the left hand side. But, and another way to look at how much testosterone was in utero when you were during the first 4 months of gestation, you can look at your hands. And in the case of women, normally the ring finger and the index finger are the same length. However, if you look at your hands and your ring finger is taller than your index finger, that means there was more testosterone, so therefore chances are that you could be better at math and at spatial abilities. If your index finger is taller than your ring finger, that means that you will be better with at verbal abilities, communication, taking care of things.
So you're talking about the pointer finger being the index finger, and then of
index,
course the
exactly.
We're skipping over the middle nasty gesture
and
finger.
And then the fourth finger, which is the ring finger.
Right. Very interesting. So there's a correlation between testosterone in utero and the length of one's ring and index fingers, relatively speaking. That's an astonishing bit of information that I can't even not even believe that there would be a relationship. But you're saying that's been, proven.
Yes, it has been proven that that has to do with the amount of testosterone.
Very interesting.
In utero.
Now, how does that relate then to our subject of brain and math? Or does it?
Testosterone helps with the development of these numerical areas in the brain, which is the inferior parietal cortex.
Sure.
On the left as well as the right-hand side, the right hemispheres, and also the intraparietal sulcus. So it helps that there it would then be a bit more neurons and a bit more gray matter in those areas of people who have been exposed to higher levels of testosterone.
Uh-huh. So now, For instance,
if you look at children who are geniuses, the relationship between male and female is 13 to 1. 13 males to 1 female. And the reason for that is because of testosterone.
Are you speaking of geniuses in any field?
Yes.
So genius...
there would probably be more genius in the field of mathematics, specifically.
I see. Now, you're going to make some feminists quite angry if you... And it may be true or not. You're saying people who are at the genius level of their field, you're saying more men fall into that category
They do. Yes, they do. I
than
mean, that's
females.
just an actual fact. There's nothing feminist, about, about that. The fact is also that if you look at intelligence IQs, tests, the majority of very intelligent people, there are very intelligent women also, but the majority are men. However, if you look at those who have the lowest scores, the majority there are also men. So women fall slap bang in the middle of that.
I see. Well, in my take on intelligence testing in general is would not fall into the conventional realm of thinking. For me,
I agree with you because everybody has different abilities, and but IQ testing is only one type of testing.
yes,
It's very biased.
I agree with that.
It's extremely biased, absolutely.
I agree with that. And some of the most screwed up people in the world are geniuses.
It's true,
I
absolutely.
recently have been reading a book about electricity and was reading about Edison, who in some ways was quite a genius, but in other ways, people said in the early parts of his life he was a man without conscience. We of course know of the temper tantrums of genius Steve Jobs and in the incredibly poor interpersonal skills that
Oh,
he
yes. I
often
mean, as you say,
demonstrated.
the higher the IQ, the lower the EQ.
You've got very good. And EQ, not and that's not just a saying. I mean, there have been books written on emotional quotient and what a important part of human psyche that is. So I really don't have a problem with what you're saying in terms of, genius ranking being given, predominantly to males, especially when you say that, the truly unintelligent members of our population also tend to be males as well.
Exactly, yes, absolutely.
So that's very
Yes,
interesting.
testosterone has its function to maybe make you a genius in certain areas, but then at the cost, definitely at the cost of other intelligences.
Absolute social
Huh?
intelligence, moral
Exactly.
intelligence, right?
Absolutely.
That kind of thing. Very interesting. Well,
So, and also another thing about testosterone that I found that was also quite, well, I found quite interesting. You thought you might also. For instance, testosterone is highest in men in the morning, right? So we know men are quite frisky in the morning.
yes.
It is also highest during REM sleep, rapid eye movement sleep, and
Yes.
it's also highest in the fall. It is lowest at the in the late afternoon, and it is lowest in the spring also.
So it sounds like you're saying if you're going to take a course in math, that you should take it in the
In
fall and sign up for a morning class as opposed to an afternoon class.
Exactly,
I mean, that sounds like that. This
So
is.
men specifically should take their math classes, yes, early morning, and they should take their language classes and creative writing classes in the afternoon.
I've never heard that, but it seems as though that makes perfect sense given the research that you're pointing to. Just little practical things that can make getting through college easier or whatever classes.
True.
Very interesting.
And for instance, estrogen in the case of, well, men also have estrogen, but of course that is the predominant hormone in women. When it is, where the fluctuation on a monthly level of estrogen is between 650 and 4,900%. I mean, do you guys now understand why us girls sometimes get quite moody?
Run those figures by me again.
I mean, can you believe that? Testosterone is between 100 and 150% a day. That's the fluctuation.
Right.
And now within the monthly cycle, menstrual cycle of women, the fluctuation is between 650 to 4,900%.
That's incredible.
It is, isn't it? So when estrogen is at its highest level, women are very good at, they have very good spatial memory. This was very important in hunter-gathering days when women had to go out and find berries and fruits and things in order to find that tree or that bush again that gave very good berries. That's what she needed. When estrogen is low, just before the menstrual cycle, that is when women are better at mental rotation, which is what men are very good at. Men, specifically because of testosterone, are very good at mental rotation, which is something that they need in order to navigate.
What you're saying, mental rotation? Are you saying mental rotation?
Mental rotation, correct.
That's a term that's new for me.
It's the two type of spatial abilities, which is mental rotation and spatial memory.
Oh, excuse me. I must take a station identification to sneeze. Just a moment.
Okay. Bless you.
Thank you very much. Okay. We're back. So what kind of practical... Do you have some practical application or observations or advice given, for our day-to-day living in this modern world, given what you've been speaking about in terms of these hormonal fluctuations?
Well, we can see that women, it's better for them to do their... language classes in the morning and to do math in the afternoon. So it's reversed from men.
Okay.
For men to do their math classes in the morning and all verbal or language classes in the afternoon.
It's bad if you're trying to meet men or women in your math class, though. If you do that, you'll have segregated math classes.
It's better to separate the sexes for math and science.
Well, it sounds like, I mean, you're not all joking aside.
Yes, because of the hormonal factors, and also because boys overall are a bit more rambunctious. They can't sit still. Girls are able to sit still and listen.
Yeah.
Boys are not. They need to move around. They want to, they talk a lot more. They interrupt a lot more. So therefore they get more attention, not because the teacher is favoring the boys, but simply because the boys demand more attention because of who they are.
Sure.
So they need to move around more, they need to interrupt more, they need to interact more, whereas the girls can sit and listen when they're supposed to. So therefore they say it may be better... Yes, to separate the sexes and also to give it at different times of the day. So the men in the morning, the boys in the morning, the girls in the afternoon.
Interesting. Well, something to think about as a former teacher, why perhaps some classes were particularly difficult to teach because you would have these inherent conflicts because of what's going on in the hormones of your students.
Exactly. Also in the case of girls, girls use a lot of verbal labels, if you would. They label things, especially when they have to resolve any kind of mathematical problem. They use a lot of verbal labels. And because of that, it takes them longer to finish a mathematical problem. In the case of boys, they don't use verbal labels. They do it more mentally, and therefore they finish a lot faster also. So that can also be a conflict within a classroom, because the boys may finish before the girls do.
Now, earlier we spoke...
Not because the one is slower than the other one, it's just they use a different method in order to solve the problem.
Right. So as a teacher, if you're trying to see that everyone is accomplishing at the same rate, it could be just an erroneous assumption on your part and, you know, a bad expectation.
Correct.
Yeah. Now, earlier you spoke of music promoting math ability. Is there any evidence that doing math helps to, you know, make for a better brain and other types of activities?
Doing math, yes, it would, because it helps the corpus callosum. It stimulates the corpus callosum, which is the bundle of nerves that unite the two hemispheres. And so therefore, the hemisphere, the corpus callosum, is a bit bigger. It has a few more neurons because it's been stimulated a bit more.
Uh-huh.
And that, of course, will then help across the board. Not only with music, it will help with everything else that you think of. Where you're able to actually unite the two hemispheres and think with both hemispheres equally activated, you will get a lot more insights. You will be able to do lateral thinking. It will be a lot easier to do lateral thinking that way. So that would be a definite plus.
So a person who grows up being a well-rounded individual, someone who does a little bit of math and a little bit of music, a little bit of literature, a little bit of chemistry, it sounds like that's going to overall produce, you know, better brain function than someone perhaps that is more along the lines of a Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, who can play the piano and little more. It might have been to his benefit to spend a little time doing a little more. Well, we know he couldn't balance his checkbook as an adult, and that was very problematic for him. So perhaps if he had been taught that, he might have lived a few more years.
Exactly. If he had taken better care of himself, you know, and had not been so into just one mode of thinking and one thing of doing, he would have exercised a bit more and taken better care of his health, and there would have been a bit better balance, right?
Well, I think...
Too much of anything is not good, for sure.
Well, I think what it seems to be pointing out is that, you know, we should try to do a little bit of everything, that we need to have variety not only in our education, but in our daily activities. So that, as I pointed out, we have a left and a right leg, and you can run much faster if you've got legs on opposite sides of the body than if you just try to hop everywhere on one foot. You know, we see better with a left and a right eye, and we hear better with two ears. And so if we use our brain, you know, in both these left brain and right brain functions, and in verbal and mathematic, and in all a variety of different ways, it will give us a stronger and better functioning brain overall that then we can apply to whatever specialized field that we may choose, you know, as our calling in life.
Oh, absolutely. Definitely. There has to be a balance in everything we do, which is also why meditation is very good, because it helps us to become mindful and to be mindful in the moment, with mindful being the new catchphrase.
Yes.
But there is a lot of truth to it, that if you're not mindful in the moment, if you don't take attention of what you're doing, and make a point of knowing, okay, I know exactly where I put down my glasses, or I know exactly where I put down my keys. When I come back and look for them, I know where I put them. It's not just a mindless thing of just putting them down and going on, oh, geez, now I'm losing my mind. No, you have to be mindful in everything that you're doing, and that will also help to bring a balance, as you were saying, into everything that you're doing. Because by being mindful, you take note of where you're good, where you're lacking, what needs improvement, where should I give more attention. No?
I feel like I had precognition about 6 hours ago, because I knew I would be speaking to you tonight, and for some reason I walked to get my hair cut earlier today, and as I was walking back, this thought came into my brain, which was that if people want to know how to make their brain work better, just be in the moment.
Exactly.
You know, and the old hippie slogan, be here now, is not, it's meaningful. It means pay attention to what is going on in the moment that you are living, and don't be living so much in the past or in the future. That was exactly my thoughts this afternoon. And so funny to hear you say that. I must have heard you say that now, back then. You follow what I'm saying?
Yes.
So a little bit of ESP perhaps, and a little bit of cosmic brain travel for me, because I agree with you 100% in terms of, you know, that philosophy of mindfulness. I won't claim to remember that all the time. Because I, you know, like everyone, I like to travel into the future, and I like to travel into the past with my brain. And I think that's, you know, if we don't have that ability, then we're gonna lose out. We need to be able to go into the future and then learn from the past, but not get so wrapped up in it and to forget that what we're doing at this
in
very
moment.
Moment.
Yes. Very true.
Yeah.
Very well put.
Well, listen, we've been talking for nearly an hour now.
Holly.
It's hard to believe. I think what we'll do is we'll just kind of end it here for this particular episode, and let's talk again in a couple of weeks.
That sounds wonderful.
And let's do this more regularly. I'm sure you'll want, you know, I'll put this up on the Brain Radar radio page. As soon as I hang up on the phone, I'll go ahead and make the MP3 file and the Windows Media file. So that'll be up online in about half an hour from now.
Oh, wonderful. Do send me the link and I'll send it to all my friends and contacts.
Well, I know you have a lot of friends, because the last time we did, I posted an audio, I got an enormous amount of traffic. So you have a lot of people, Mary Lou, who are interested in what you've learned and what you've have to say. And I'm always, as always, very, very grateful to have you as a friend, and as helping in the brain revolution here. And
absolutely, I've learned so much from you also, all your books and all the research.
Well, thank you very much.
I'm a big fan of you, for sure.
Well, thank you, Mary Lou. I appreciate that. Well, tell you what, I'll say goodbye tonight. I'll put this online, and then let's talk again in a couple weeks, all right?
That sounds great. Regards to Julia.
All right, and goodbye to everyone on Brain Radar Radio, and we'll see you next time.